Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
In today's Africa Link program, DRC President Joseph Kabila names a new transitional government defying the opposition.
When you look at the transition government, a lot of the members are from Kabila's majority.
And is armed conflict increasing in Africa?
Yes. The only moderately bright spot is Boko Haram, which has seen a 70% decline in fatalities.
Stay tuned for these stories. Plus,
the hashtag Mombasa Rains is trending. We bring you more on that stories on our social media chat.
Hello and welcome to Africa Link with me, Crispin Mwakideu.
And me, Wanjiko Mwaura in Bonn, Germany.
And before we get started, here's a chance to find out what's been happening around the world.
I'm Shay Meineke with DW News. Democratic Republic of Congo President Joseph Kabila has named a new interim government, announcing on state TV on Tuesday that roughly 60 ministers from his previous government would join the new administration. The main opposition has decried the announcement, saying Kabila should appoint a government that respects a December agreement, which allows him to remain as president provided he holds elections by the end of this year. Political tensions have aroused fears of worsening violence in the Central African country. Investigators have detained another member of the German armed forces, holding in custody 27-year-old Bundeswehr soldier identified as Maximilian T. The right-wing extremist allegedly planned a severe act of violence against the state and is believed to be an accomplice of 24-year-old student Matthias F. and right-wing Lieutenant Franco A., who was arrested in April after falsely registering as a refugee to carry out xenophobic attacks. Federal prosecutor Frauke Kohler told reporters about the arrest.
Based on our information so far, the three defendants were planning an attack on the lives of high-ranking politicians and people of public life who, in the eyes of the defendants, are actively involved in failed policies on refugees and foreigners.
Ausländer fragen engagieren.
In the Central African Republic, a UN peacekeeper was killed and four others went missing after their convoy was attacked in the southeast of the country. The UN said Tuesday that eight peacekeepers were injured in the attack and have sent a helicopter and soldiers to search for the missing four. The wounded were evacuated to Bangui. This news comes to you from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. The International Criminal Court has sounded off against war crimes in Libya, with the court's prosecutor telling the UN Security Council on Tuesday that thousands of migrants are being held inhumanely in detention centers across the North African country. ICC prosecutor Fatou Bensouda said she is deeply alarmed by the crimes.
It is undoubtedly disconcerting to this council that the ongoing political instability and the volatile security situation in Libya have reportedly led to the widespread commission of serious crimes. Reports of continued killings of civilians should be of great concern to all of us.
Protests have hit South Africa's capital, Johannesburg, as residents pelted police cars with stones and blocked a highway with burning tires. Police and riot gear responded by firing rubber bullets and stun grenades on the crowd, who were demonstrating against a lack of housing and jobs, putting further pressure on President Jacob Zuma's government to fix a worsening economy and sluggish job market. Police said at least 15 people were arrested. And finally, gunmen have attacked the convoy of South Sudan's vice president, wounding three bodyguards as it headed north from capital Juba. The country's state minister of information said Vice President Taban Dangai was not in the convoy at the time of the attack and that the convoy reached the town of Bor safely. For more news and information, visit our website at dw.com. I'm Shay Meineke.
You're listening to Africa Link with me, Crispin Mwakideu.
And me, Wanjiko Mwaura.
And we begin in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where President Joseph Kabila today named a new transitional government. It will comprise roughly 60 ministers and vice ministers, most of whom were drawn from the previous government. The opposition says Kabila's move is in violation of an agreement meant to end Congo's political crisis. Melanie Gubi is a freelance journalist keenly following the developments in DRC, and she's been telling me what President Kabila hopes to achieve with this move.
Well, I think that what's been clear since the beginning of the negotiation is that President Kabila is trying to divide the opposition and is trying to avoid to have to deal with a proper transition government made of opposition members that will really try to organize election and have a real transition. The prime minister he named a few weeks ago, Bruno Tshibala, is a former member of the UDPS, the main opposition party, but he's been expelled from that party because he had major disagreement with Félix Tshisekedi, who was the de facto leader since his father, Étienne Tshisekedi, died at the beginning of the year. And so Bruno Tshibala was, someone that the opposition coalition didn't want to be the prime minister, didn't recognize to be a legitimate nomination for the prime minister. And the opposition coalition said that his nomination was in violation of the agreement that was signed at the end of 2016. The transition government that was nominated today is not really a surprise in the sense that the prime minister, Bruno Tshibala, was already not someone. His nomination was already not in respect of this political deal that was signed.
Coming back to this cabinet now, does it have what it takes now to bring stability to Congo and probably usher in a new government by the end of the year or next year for that matter?
When you look at the transition government, a lot of the members are from Kabila's majority. So it's unclear what they actually are going to be doing and what they're going to be able to do in the current context. Congo clearly is becoming more and more unstable. There's fighting in Kasai. There is fighting in the east, and people are worried and angry that the election haven't been held yet.
Freelance journalist Melanie Gobi. Let's return to Germany, where investigators have confirmed the arrest of a second soldier who's accused of plotting to carry out attacks. The soldier allegedly helped plan a hit list which included former President Joachim Gauck and Justice Minister Heiko Maas. Germany's military, known as the Bundeswehr, has been rocked by a scandal after a right-wing extremist posed as a refugee with an intention to attack refugees. Bettina Steckemper reports.
Their sights were set on former German President Joachim Gauck, as well as on Justice Minister Heiko Maas. Investigators found their names on a list of potential targets. According to what we've discovered so far, the three suspects were planning an attack on the life of senior politicians and public figures committed to what the suspects considered to be misguided refugee and immigration policies. Police officers arrested the 27-year-old lieutenant here in Kehl on the border with France. The arrest has raised concerns of a right-wing terror cell within the German armed forces. Investigators are searching barracks across the country for evidence pointing to right-wing extremism or anything glorifying Germany's Nazi past. In a talk show on Sunday, German Defense Minister Ursula von der Leyen suggested the authorities are likely to uncover more evidence. A lot will be churned up here. I'm warning everyone, we can't be laid back about this. The worst is yet to come. Investigators believe the suspects had cooked up a sophisticated plan to deflect attention. The evidence we've uncovered so far suggests Franco A. was to execute the attack himself. To do this, he had registered under a fictitious identity, posing as a Syrian refugee seeking asylum. In this way, the three suspects wanted to steer suspicion after the attack towards asylum seekers living here. On Wednesday, a special session of the German Parliament's Defense Committee will convene to discuss the case. The German Defense Minister will no doubt face a barrage of uncomfortable questions.
And that report was written by Bettina Steckemper. Now, only yesterday we covered a story how fighting in South Sudan has displaced more than 2 million children. We also brought you the good news of the release of 82 Chibok girls from Boko Haram. These two stories from two different countries highlight the impact of armed conflict in Africa. Today, the International Institute for Strategic Studies launched its 2017 Armed Conflict Survey. I've been speaking to Dr. Anastasia Voronkova, the service editor, to find out where the fighting is increasing in sub-Saharan Africa.
Yes, the only moderately bright spot is Boko Haram, which has seen a 70% decline in fatalities. But the group remains quite strong. It remains capable of perpetrating hit-and-run attacks, nighttime raids, isolated suicide attacks, which continue to be registered across the Lake Chad basin as well as in some territories in Nigeria. Even though the security forces expelled the group from a growing number of areas, they have also had difficulty holding on to the gains that they made in 2015.
In the 2017 survey, what were the main reasons that you discovered that are fueling these armed conflicts in Africa?
Definitely one of the ongoing aspects that continue to fuel the conflicts is ongoing state weakness and lack of legitimacy of state institutions and governance problems in most of African countries. In Somalia, in the Central African Republic, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, to a great extent in South Sudan, we are seeing a very, very, very weak presence of state institutions. And it is very difficult for international actors to do anything substantive in the absence of the underlying legitimacy of the state for the local population. I think one of the themes that we are also discussing in this year's survey is that the peacekeeping forces that are deployed in many African countries, conflicts are also quite stretched. They are performing a wide variety of tasks, and they are hardly coping with the mandate. They are finding it increasingly difficult to find a sort of strong kind of support among the local population and are generally struggling to provide security.
Dr. Anastasia Voronkova of the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London.
And on social media, people have been reacting to this story. One Ibrahim London Uba says, "We just pray for peace, and we cannot blame any religion in the instances of these armed conflict regions."
That's right, Wanjiku. And there's another comment from Timo Mborg who says, "I think they have done less harm than when what the Americans have done. We should go for the big boys first, the root of the problem."
Yes, indeed. Now, Crispin, there's something else that has been trending on social media, and that is Mombasa floods.
Hashtag Mombasa rains, Mombasa floods. That's right. Heavy rains have been pounding the coastal city of Kenya for the past 2 days and causing havoc in Mombasa.
Yes, indeed. And a couple of people have died, and actually the number has increased to 9. And people have been talking about it, of course. Some have been blaming poor infrastructures. Of course, politics is also something else that has gotten in the mix of this discussion when it comes to flooding and what the government, the county government, should have done. Now, Ahmed Mohammed says that it's not true that Mombasa has a poor drainage system, that Mombasa is a coastal town in Kenya. He continues to say Mombasa has no drainage system, and silence from the Mombasa leadership is deafening.
Right. And then Ole Naipota says, "Where is the national government?" Mohamed Hersi also writes in and says the Mbogolo Bridge between Mombasa and Kilifi is totally submerged. The road has been closed. Please don't try a hero's act, or don't try to be a hero.
Yes, indeed. Another comment here from Siambiliki says a super effective stormwater drainage system will save our lives, roads and property. Is anyone out there listening? Clearly, people are asking for the government to step in and take charge when it comes to drainage.
That's right, Wanjiku. So if you're in Mombasa, please do take care. And if you're following these stories, please do let us know how you're faring on with your comments by visiting DW Africa Facebook page. This is Africa Link with me, Crispin Mwakideo.
And Wanjiko Mora.
Coming up in the next 15 minutes, how one Ghanaian young man was prevented from joining the so-called Islamic State.
He started chatting with me the kind of work I was doing, what I was about to do, and I told him that I'm just a graduate.
And what have you been saying about that story? We find out a little later in the show.
Stay with us for these stories. Plus, beers and brains in Rwanda, how an initiative is motivating startups while at the same time enjoying their favorite beer. But let's head to Ghana, where a civic society group is fighting online recruitment by the so-called Islamic State. The extremist group is taking advantage of youth unemployment in the West African country. As Isaac Kalechi reports, according to the group, 20 youths have so far been helped from being recruited.
Young people here in Ghana have been recruited from terror group Islamic State, or IS for short. Take this 21-year-old young senior high school graduate from Ghana's northern region, for instance. He wants to be called Amin, to not give away his identity. Amin almost joined IS last year after he was contacted online by someone from the terror organization. We've also changed Amin's voice to protect his identity.
I was frustrated and depressed at the beginning. He started chatting with me the kind of work I was doing, what I was about to do, and I told him that I'm just graduating 2013. He asked me, should in case I get a work that can fetch me billions of dollars, will I agree to do such a work? Because I was under pressure and frustration, I easily accepted.
But Amin came across an outreach program on TV just in time. The guest was a counter-extremism expert who spoke about radicalization of young Muslims and getting them to join IS.
I just finished chatting with him and I went inside to take my breakfast. Unfortunately, on my part, I tuned to TV3. And God being so wonderful, the topic they were discussing was radicalization. So in case I did not have the chance to watch that program that very Friday, well, I think I wouldn't have been alive by now, because I would have gone and I was not thinking what would have happened to me.
One of the key things that they are concerned about is publicity. Giving them publicity. That's what they don't want to.
The counter-extremism expert on TV that day was Mutaru Mumuni Mukhtar, whose group, West Africa Center for Counter-Extremism, has been working to discourage people like Amin from joining terror groups like IS.
In the last 2 years, we have been able to prevent, you know, at least 22 people from becoming radicalized to engage in terrorism. People who have had in a situation we describe as very vulnerable to terrorism because they've been radicalized here.
The counter-extremism group regularly holds sessions with Muslim youth from vulnerable communities where poverty is high. Some of the civil society group's programs are also broadcast on TV and radio in order to reach more youth. Mukhtar says his work has been challenging.
This area of work is not easy. It's been a difficult experience in terms of trying to counter, you know, individual, dissuade individuals from getting radicalized or getting involved in terrorist activities either here or outside the country. And so in the last 2 years, we've been working with youth groups and community leaders in communities we describe as suspect communities or vulnerable communities to counter the factors that could possibly motivate them to become radicalized. And it has been very revealing because we've come across, you know, individuals who have been radicalized here and many more who have been predisposed to radicalization.
Mukhtar and his team of 6 workers have close working relationships with the government security agencies in Ghana, and they hope to expand their work to other countries in West Africa, especially Nigeria, where Boko Haram militants are wreaking havoc.
DW correspondent Isaac Kalechi in Accra.
Ben Mensah from Ghana wrote in and said, "This Islamic State group is causing fear and panic among nations. We all need to come together and fight this menace. They've attacked France, Nigeria and other countries."
And then Frederick Mulika, originally from Uganda but lives in the USA, says Ghana's civil society should be credited for trying to stop youth from joining the terrorist organization. The government of Ghana can't alone fight terrorism. It will collectively support. It needs the collective support from civil society and the international community.
Africa on the move.
Rwanda is often referred to as the Singapore of Africa due to the rising number of startups based in the country. And to inspire upcoming social entrepreneurs, creativity comes into play. So why not beers and brains? These are monthly sessions where social entrepreneurs bring challenges facing their startups while sharing a drink. From Kigali, DW's Gaius Koweni takes to the heart of this unusual approach.
I am at the Impact Hub offices in the Rwandan capital, Kigali. About 100 social entrepreneurs have gathered in groups while sharing some beer and wine. They are here for the second session of Beers and Brains, an event which brings together young entrepreneurs and business mentors. They get advice for free of charge on how to solve problems facing their startups.
All right, so we're piloting this new format of the program. So can we just take 5 minutes to like introduce yourself to somebody that you don't know yet?
John Stever is a co-founder of Impact Hub. Last March, he organized the first Beers and Brains session in partnership with One Acre Fund, an organization supporting farmers in Africa. During a recent conversation with a friend managing a startup in the neighboring Uganda, Stever came across this concept where an entrepreneur would buy beers for peers in exchange for advice.
We're really trying to push this culture of peer mentorship and supporting each other with business ideas, and also creating an opportunity for students or other young people that are interested in entrepreneurship to come and see what issues businesses are thinking about and help them develop their own ideas.
At the event at Impact Hub, Kigali Farms, a startup promoting the culture of mushrooms for business and nutritional purposes, has a challenge.
That's the challenge we have in front of us right now. It's like, how do we make people in there adopt oyster mushrooms on a large, large scale? That's the question.
After getting inputs from the peers, Laurent Demug, Kigali Farms CEO, has some new ideas.
Answers I got was, okay, figure out what they don't like about it, okay, yes. Education, I mean, make sure that they understand the nutritional value of it, yeah. So now I know price is an issue, so I throw that out there. So any ideas for how to reduce the cost of the mushrooms to the people in the countryside?
Other participants at the second Beers and Brains session tell me how much the meeting is important for them.
I like a place where people are sharing business ideas, telling the secret tactics to do businesses.
And I don't think the beer dumbs you down. I think it kind of releases the pressure for some people.
This is my first time at the event, but I don't see why have such a wonderful event with amazing people here with a lot of expertise and then give the platform to like an expat.
In coming days, Stever hopes to expand the Beers and Brains sessions to the whole country so to allow as many entrepreneurs as possible get involved in entrepreneurial gatherings.
And that report was compiled by Gaius Koweni in Kigali.
Awamba Anaba from Ghana, West Africa says, I like Rwanda, their entrepreneurial ability. Ah, this country is taking a good shape. Beautiful Rwanda.
Focus Europe.
Now, at a time when many in Europe are building walls and facing off their countries to keep off migrants, the French city of Strasbourg and the German city of Kiel are knocking down a few instead. The two cities have just inaugurated a new tram that runs between them in one of the very few cross-border tram services on the continent. Kate Hersine went to take a ride.
On weekdays, around 20,000 cars use this bridge over the Rhine River to commute between Kiel in Germany and Strasbourg in France, and even more cars travel on weekends. With higher unemployment in the Alsace region on the French side, a fifth of all insured workers in Kiel are French. Also, Kiel's lower property prices in the last few years have attracted several thousand French families whose children still travel back to Strasbourg to attend school. Until now, all of these commuters have had to drive their cars or take the bus across this bridge, which is renowned for traffic jams.
Prochaine station, Kiel Bahnhof.
And this helps explain why everyone I talk to is incredibly enthusiastic about Strasbourg's new tram that now runs across the border to Kiel. The cross-border tram isn't just convenient, though. It's also highly symbolic. In the past, this tract of the Rhine River experienced centuries of conflict. In fact, the last tram to run between the two cities stopped in the final days of World War II, when Strasbourg was liberated from German occupation. Kiel celebrated the tram's arrival with a festival on the banks of the Rhine. From here, just 300 metres separate the two banks. But with German laws governing one side and French laws the other, it still took 12 years of negotiations and 44 million euros for the tram to be able to cross the river. Annette Lipowski from the Kiel City Council was involved every step of the way.
It's unbelievable how much money we spent just in lawyers' fees. At times, we sat at the table with seven different legal specialists in French and German law.
The difficulties range from both the German and French federal governments having to sign off on an agreement for the new tram bridge, which took nearly 2 years to pass through various levels of parliament. Then there were years of legal wrangling over operating issues, such as trams needing to be outfitted with indicators and high beam headlights under German law, but not under French law.
For instance, it took 3 years just to negotiate the ticket pricing. In Strasbourg, you can ride on all public transport for an hour with just one ticket. But in Germany, the further you travel, the more you pay. So the regional and state governments in Germany said, well, Strasbourg is further, so the ticket should cost more. But you can't expect everyone to buy different tickets. So it took a while to find a solution everyone could live with.
During a visit to the tram festival at Kiel, Strasbourg's Lord Mayor Roland Rees stressed that the successful completion of the tram wouldn't have been possible without changing attitudes on both sides of the river.
On avait terminé la guerre, bien sûr, mais les mentalités restaient un peu...
When the war was over, attitudes were still a bit, let's say, antagonistic about what happened on the other side of the river. When I was young, I never came to Kiel. But now it's completely different. As you can see here, everyone is happy to see each other. For me, this is the Europe of the future.
That report was compiled by Kate Hairsine.
Now, let's go back to Mombasa in Kenya, where they have experienced heavy flooding after 2 days of rain, heavy rainfall. Comments coming in. The MC Justo says baby crocodiles are said to have been swept away by floods in Mombasa's Mamba village and are seen floating around the Nyali area. Take care, people, he adds.
Right, and speaking of escaped animals, in South Africa, five male lions have escaped from Kruger National Park, according to officials. That's the country's biggest wildlife reserve.
Yes, indeed. And the National Park Service went on Twitter, Crispin, and they said that the team had dated already two of the lions and the remaining escapees had been spotted so far. So that's good from that end.
All right, but there's still one lion, I understand, who's still roaming and needs to be... to be taken care of.
Yes, indeed. Kuti Chatan says, I'm more worried about the welfare of the lions, actually. I hope they return safely back to the protected area.
And then Hallie Antonio Wood says, now, when people from overseas ask us if lions roam the streets, we have to answer with a yes, occasionally.
This reminds me of a recent incident also in Kenya where the national parks roamed from the Nairobi National Park onto the street, stopping traffic, and everyone was mesmerized at the fact that they were just comfortable on the streets, of course.
That's right. Another comment from Langa Lomso, who says it won't be long before South Africans demand a lion capture report. Hashtag lions escape.
And Bridget adds on to say the economy is so tight that lions are bribing security guards and running away from South Africa.
Interesting comment there from Bridget. Kogisari Matipe says, thank God they managed to retrieve four lions before sunset. Hopefully they'll find the remaining one as soon as possible. And then we end this edition of Africa Link. Thank you for listening. From me, Crispin Mwakideo.
And me, Wanjiko Mwaura.
Goodbye and stay safe.